Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. 25 years ago today, Illinois and the Midwest were in the stifling grip of a heat wave. Hot weather is not all that unusual in this part of the world at this time of year, but this particular heat wave was different.
Thursday, and the heat began to get our attention. 106 degrees, a new record.
It's hot. It's hot out there. We all walk out there. It's very, very, very hot.
We had an extraordinary number of deaths from the field when the ambulances call us for medical control.
The medical examiner's office today is examining 117 fatalities. This is the highest number, single-day caseload in the history of the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office.
Ultimately, Chicago would record 739 heat-related deaths over 5 days. Yesterday, I taped a conversation about the 1995 heat wave with Eric Kleinenberg. He's the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor of Social Science at New York University and director of NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. He's also the author of the books Palaces for the People, Going Solo, and, most important for our conversation, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. Eric Kleinenberg, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I just want to begin by asking you if you can sort of take us back to set the scene, summer of 1995 in Chicago. Can you talk about how extraordinary this heat was? What would people have seen if they had been there at the time?
Well, the heat was extraordinary, but of course, one of the things about the heat that's so tricky is you don't see anything. I mean, it's not really a camera-ready disaster like a hurricane or a tornado or a flood. And so what that means is that even though the heat was visible to meteorologists in advance, and they could see this dangerous hot weather system moving up to Chicago, there weren't spectacular and scary images that you could put on television or on the front page of a newspaper. So people didn't really take it all that seriously. And, you know, the temperatures were very high. It hit 106 degrees in Chicago. And the heat index, which is a blend of heat and humidity, it tells you what the typical person feels. That got up to 126. So that's very extreme. But the extraordinary thing is that, you know, if you were in Chicago, you would not have seen the mayor because he was on vacation. And you would not have seen the health commissioner because she was on vacation. And you would not have seen the fire commissioner because he was on vacation. I mean, basically, the A-team had left Chicago. And they did not feel hearkened back by anything that they were seeing on TV.
Quite a far cry from today, where we've gotten used to, you know, governors and mayors holding daily televised briefings, sort of updating people on every, you know, turn of the screw in the disaster.
Well, I mean, again, the similarities between heat wave and the COVID crisis are really amazing to me. I mean, in Chicago in 1995, the scientists were warning that there could be a very dangerous thing coming towards the city. And the mayor at the time kept downplaying the significance of it. And even when the outbreak started, he kept saying, look, you know, you can't call everybody who dies a heat death. And of course, now with the COVID pandemic, we've had exactly the same thing happen at the national level, right? A president who just continually insist that the thing is not real, it's a flu, everyone's going to be fine, we've got it under control. And so I have been struck by all the parallels. Of course, now, you know, Chicago takes heat more seriously, but not really the underlying things that make it more dangerous.
Yeah, and I want to come back to some of those parallels between COVID-19 and the heat wave, but sticking with the summer of 1995 for now, and you have these images in your book, Heat wave of, you know, city workers having to hose down bridges to prevent them from locking, and tens of thousands of people swarming the beach. Can you talk a little bit about the battle the city seemed to be waging with people trying to crank open fire hydrants to cool down?
Yeah, well, look, the heat was overwhelming. And if for the millions of people who didn't have a beach home, you know, they were stuck. And, you know, Chicagoans did what we always do to stay cool these days. We turned on air conditioning, and so many people turned on air conditioning at the same time that the city's power grid failed. And so hundreds of thousands of homes and, you know, more people suddenly had no access to AC. If they lived in a high-rise building, the elevators didn't work. You couldn't pump water over the fifth or sixth floor. You know, what that meant is that the traffic lights were out in much of the city. The heat made plates expand on bridges and the train rails were melting a little bit. And so there was big traffic jams all over the place. I mean, it was really a disaster. And what happened in poor neighborhoods is, you know, they generally don't have great access to air conditioning. And so people were opening up fire hydrants. And then the city got worried. So many hydrants were opened at the same time that it was causing water pressure to be all but gone.
This is what the water department is trying to stop. 3,000 illegally opened fire hydrants. This one we saw today spewing thousands of gallons of water into the street for at least 8 hours. Just a few blocks away, residents of South Hermitage have been without water pressure most of the day, without water on a day where you can feel and see the heat rising from the ground.
No water. And I have babies, and we need water.
And so the city started sending emergency crews to close down the hydrants, and people would throw stones and bottles. It was a battle for life and death in a city that wasn't really ready for it.
And so you talk about power outages and sort of mass dehydration, and ultimately hundreds and hundreds of people die. I obviously, everybody has an individual story, but in the aggregate, what happened that caused so many people to expire during this heat wave?
Well, you know, it was unrelenting heat, and Chicago has very deep and severe poverty. There are record numbers of people in Chicago in 1995 who are aging alone or living alone. There's major issues with social isolation. There are neighborhoods on the south side and the west side of Chicago where, you know, the institutions have gone. The employers are gone. The grocery stores are gone. The public institutions are in terrible shape. And people hunker down at home rather than go out into the streets and into public settings to be with each other. And what that means is that there's no one checking up on them when they start to overheat. And there's a tricky thing about heat-related illnesses, which is that people experiencing them don't necessarily feel how bad it is. They don't realize that their body is breaking down until it's too late. And so generally what you need to get through a heat wave is someone to see you and recognize you're not doing well. If that happens, it's really easy. You cool someone down in water. You drive to a cooling center if there's a cooling center that's open. But unfortunately, too many people in Chicago wound up isolated, out of touch, and just succumbing to the heat. You saw it in the most kind of poor and depleted neighborhoods, and you also saw it in the single-room occupancy dwellings around the Loop and Uptown.
So there are so many people who died, and you highlight a lot of their stories in the book. Are there any that stand out to you all these years later that you wrote about?
There was a woman who told me a story about the way that she tried to get through the heat wave by putting a cold washcloth on her face and putting a fan on herself and closing her eyes and pretending that she was on a cruise somewhere, even though she was trapped indoors in a small apartment in Uptown. And she made it through, but it was just felt like a very lonely way to get through it. I'll never forget the visits I made to the single room occupancy dwellings in the Loop and on the north side of Chicago, where they had multiple fatalities, places where very poor and isolated men who were really down and out lived with kind of conditions that I found hard to believe. I think one of the things that really strikes me and that hit home most as someone who grew up in Chicago is that I got exposed in writing this book to a brutality in the city that I didn't quite understand. I hadn't been quite aware of just how severe the inequality is, about how dangerous everyday conditions are, and how thin the line is between the kind of slow motion disaster of everyday life in the poorest parts of Chicago and the acute emergency of a heat wave. There are a lot of people who died in the heat wave because they were close to death all the time.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Eric Kleinenberg. He's a sociologist at New York University and the author of Heat Wave. We're talking about the 1995 heat wave that killed more than 700 people in the city of Chicago and in other cities as well in the Midwest. So the heat claimed people from all different walks of life, young and old, black and white. But on the whole, are there characteristics shared by a majority of the victims?
Well, I mean, the heat was not an equal opportunity killer. The African Americans were the most likely to die. The people who lived in very poor and segregated and also abandoned and depleted neighborhoods on the South and West Side were far more likely to die. Older people were more likely to die. People with underlying health conditions were more likely to die. People who were socially isolated were in real trouble. In many respects, the profile of the victims matches the profile of the victims of the COVID-19 pandemic. And you know, one of the things that's been so hard for me these last few months is seeing the United States make so many of the same mistakes that Chicago made, you know, refusing to take seriously the threat, but also really refusing to protect people who need protection, and kind of treating the issue more as a public relations crisis than like a public health crisis.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So you write, in fact, I think that's the titles of one of the chapters in your book is, you know, this something public relations as opposed to actually dealing with the disaster. What were some of the failures of government? You already mentioned that the A-team was out of town for the most part in the city. What were some of the other things that the city should have been doing but didn't do?
Well, look, the city had a heat emergency plan, which it never used. I mean, imagine coming up with an emergency plan for a heat wave, having the worst heat wave in the history of your city, and then letting it stay on the bookshelves. I mean, that was madness. The city had a plan for calling in backup paramedics from outlying suburban areas that weren't hard hit. No one did it. They decided not to. The city could have deployed more community police officers, which were all the rage in 1995, to come and check in on people. Didn't do it. Case after case, the city had no system for coordinating medical care. It didn't know which hospitals were on bypass status, which meant that they closed and couldn't take new patients into the emergency room, and which were open. And so you had paramedics driving for miles while there was a backup because so many thousands were in use. The city's messaging was horrible. Instead of issuing specific instructions on how people could stay safe or protect those around them, the mayor was challenging the mortality statistics that the medical examiner was putting out, much like Trump challenges the data that comes from the CDC or Fauci today.
At this point, the number of heat-related deaths could exceed 500, a figure which has evoked strong reaction from Mayor Daley.
You cannot claim everyone that has died in the last 8 or 9 days or continually die of heat.
The funeral homes are full. There's a shortage of caskets.
The most devastating impact of the heat can be seen at the Cook County Medical Examiner's office. 7 refrigerated trucks are in the back parking lot, handling the overflow of bodies caused by a record number of deaths.
The city really bungled this effort. And I believe that far more people died than would have had the city taken it seriously. But again, it's not like it's all the mayor's fault. Chicago is a city that just is willing to accept an extraordinary level of poverty, an extraordinary level of racial segregation and injustice. That's just part of the everyday structure of the city. And people in Chicago, for the most part, especially white people in Chicago, seem pretty fine with that arrangement. And the heat wave was just an expression of that inequality sped up so that you could see it all happening in real time.
And another institution in Chicago you spend time looking at is the role that the media played in the disaster. And I mean, you talk about both during the event, there was coverage, but then that subsided pretty quickly. And you describe this Tribune investigation as, you know, I think we've become accustomed after 9/11 to seeing individual deaths and mass tragedies. The media tries to give everyone some dignity in terms of covering the deaths, but there was apparently an effort. Can you talk a little bit about the effort that was started at the Tribune and ultimately abandoned, or at least scaled way back in the way it finally made it into print?
Yeah, I mean, look, as someone who grew up reading the Tribune, I can say that, you know, was once a great newspaper, but for some reason the Tribune had real blockage when it came to this issue. And during the heat wave itself, it was falsely reporting that the heat wave victims were just like typical people in Chicago. They, you know, kind of refused to take the demography of the disaster seriously. They had a headline that said many of the victims rejected any kind of help, you know, which kind of gives you the impression that the reason people died is because they turned away, you know, helpful people who were knocking on their doors with air conditioners and water and things like that. None of that was true. And then after the coverage, after the event, a number of reporters at the Tribune were really frustrated. They felt like they had not done a decent job on the story. And so they lobbied an editor to do a, you know, big, more investigative piece on what went wrong. And several different reporters put these profiles together. And by the time they were ready, it was November, and they brought the package of reporting to an editor. And the editor said, you know, this is really a summer story. That was their concept, a summer story. And people just aren't going to be interested in it. So instead of publishing a big investigation, the Tribune, you know, had a little story with some, you know, profiles of a few of the people who died. And I have to say, you know, I spent some time over the weekend doing an interview with a Tribune journalist who expressed a lot of interest in the coverage of the event. And I talked about the, you know, the things that I think are the big drivers of the disaster, you know, race and inequality and social isolation and public policy failure. And in the article the Tribune published on Sunday, the story they push is basically the lesson from Chicago is air conditioning saves lives. And I just thought, like, what a heartbreaking and colossal disappointment it is that after 25 years, you know, the paper of record in Chicago still can't get the story right.
Coming up, more from my conversation with Eric Kleinenberg about the parallels between the 1995 heat wave and the coronavirus pandemic, his work on how social infrastructure can help fight inequality, and a sociologist's view of what's been a remarkable year. All that's coming up after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Before the break, we were talking to NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg about the 1995 Chicago heat wave. Kleinenberg literally wrote the book on that disaster, published back in 2002. His most recent book is called Palaces for the People. It's his argument that social infrastructure, parks, libraries, that sort of thing, can help cure a lot of what ails American society in 2020. I spoke with Kleinenberg yesterday afternoon, but as always, we'd love to hear what you thought about today's conversation. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Eric Kleinenberg. You've talked a couple of times now about the parallels between the deaths in the heat wave in 1995 and the deaths and who is doing a lot of the dying in the COVID-19 pandemic. These are the more impoverished populations, Black and Brown communities, at least in Chicago, and I think in many other cities, are the ones who are doing a great disproportionate share of the infections and the deaths, especially related to COVID-19. And can you talk a little bit more about some of those drivers in terms of segregation and poverty and how those things relate to both of these crises?
Well, one thing to know is that, you know, these things that we've come to call underlying conditions, you know, which are in many ways expressions of inequality inside the body, you know, make you as vulnerable to the heat as they make you to COVID-19. So if you don't have good access to healthcare on a regular basis, things that are controllable problems for other people will prove to be uncontrollable for you. If that's diabetes, if that's hypertension, heart disease, there's any number of things that we know now are related to vulnerability in COVID-19, they're also underlying conditions that made you more vulnerable to the heat wave. And I have been very outspoken over the years of saying that I think Chicago has done a very good job of generating an emergency plan for heat, but has really failed to take seriously the underlying issues and conditions that made the heat so deadly in the first place, because Chicago did so little to address neighborhood poverty and neighborhood health crisis that, by the way, makes the life expectancy gap in Chicago worse than in any other city. You probably have reported on the fact that if you go from Streeterville downtown in Chicago to Englewood and on the south side of Chicago, the life expectancy drops 30 years. That's remarkable and disgraceful for Chicago. So it happens, it matters and shapes life and death all the time. But in a disaster or a pandemic, that really sets people up for failure. And so there are definitely differences between the heat deaths and the COVID-19 deaths. I mean, for instance, Latinos were really well protected from the heat wave because they tend to live in multi-generational households much more than white people and Black people. They're in denser neighborhoods. That made them less likely to die alone in the heat wave, but more likely to die from COVID-19. So there are some, you know, significant differences, but the main thing is that if you let a community get really sick, it's going to fare much more poorly in a crisis.
Be that crisis, heat, or pandemic, or hurricane, or anything else. I was hoping we could talk and pivot a little bit to talking about your most recent book, which is Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And I was interested that right there on page one of the book, you start where we've been talking about, which is the heat wave in Chicago. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about, you know, what is social infrastructure, and how... I wonder how you've seen its, after setting up what it is, how you've seen its failures play out in both the response to the heat wave and possibly the response to COVID-19.
Well, in this more recent book, I say that social infrastructure is the set of physical places that shape our interactions. Places like libraries and community centers, parks, playgrounds, schools, things like that. And argument I make is that those social infrastructures that we rely on can either make it much easier to connect with people around us, to build bridges, to generate social support, to build something that feels like community, or if we neglect them, they can keep us at home. So they mattered in the heat wave because neighborhoods that had a robust social infrastructure, even if they were poor and segregated, actually fared pretty well. It was amazing to see neighborhoods that had every reason to suffer come out okay because the street life, the public spaces of their neighborhood facilitated social support. But also, if you lived in a neighborhood that was really depleted and didn't have viable public spaces, you were just much more likely to be home and alone. And so, that's the opening story of Palaces for the People, because I think it was really the discovery from my heatwave research that got me thinking about social infrastructure more generally. Now I think it's an interesting question. You know, what happens to our collective life during and after COVID? I guess a lot of people are worried that we're going to feel like we need to be home and separate from each other for a long time to come. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I guess I can't help but conclude that Americans are incapable of the kind of physical distancing that we need to survive COVID in the short term. We've clearly failed in a way that no other group on earth has. And in some ways, that's a sign of just our failure to look after each other and think about each other's needs. It's also an expression of just how much people want to be out in public, no matter what the risk is. And so I kind of believe that when this is over and when we have a vaccine, I hope we get a vaccine or a better treatment, people will rush back out into the public realm. And the question is whether we create a public realm that is accommodating and that makes collective life safer and more pleasurable. You know, there was an article that came out this past weekend in the New York Times suggesting that maybe Manhattan should get rid of cars and just be more of a pedestrian city. It's going to be important for us to have a big debate about the kind of world we want to build after this pandemic ends.
I wonder if you see the lack of civic or social infrastructure in some neighborhoods. I understand where people can't get to a cooling center or a library or something like that in a heat wave. Do you think that played a role in maybe preventing people from understanding the threat maybe that COVID-19 posed to them? Do you see the sort of the shortcomings in our civic infrastructure, our social infrastructure as playing a role in exacerbating the pandemic?
You know, it's too early to say. It's something that I'm trying to investigate. I'm actually writing a book about the pandemic right now and trying to figure this out. There's some early evidence that, you know, neighborhoods that really foster a tight interpersonal connection had more vulnerability at first because people are so used to being with each other that they were more susceptible to the virus. But, and this is really interesting, I think, that as it became clear that contact was as dangerous as it was, that places with high levels of social capital, you know, wound up changing their behavior more quickly and becoming more mutually, regarding, thinking about each other, and then bringing their case levels down. So it's possible that strong social infrastructure and strong social bonds had a kind of paradoxical effect here. And I don't know if that's really true. That's just some kind of early speculation based on some early data. But clearly, one of the real crises we have right now comes from Americans not taking each other's needs and vulnerabilities seriously and being more motivated by their own will to have individual freedom, you know, to do whatever they want to do because it feels good, than our sense of obligation to other people around us, our sense of responsibility as members of a community. And so I have to believe that, you know, stronger social capital and building social infrastructure that encourages us to be together is the kind of thing that would help us build a better world moving forward, one where we can really protect each other.
I wonder if this is an opportunity for your argument, right? Because people are so deprived from this social interaction now. Is this a time where you can say, look, this is this thing you're missing out on. We need to focus on that and enhance these public spaces where we can actually come together and do great things?
You know, I've been making that argument, and I think one reason it's important is because the pandemic is not going away, and then we're going to have a situation where there are tens of millions of Americans who are out of jobs, and we're an economy or a society if we don't make a pretty serious public investment in each other. And it seems to me like, as horrible as this moment is, it's also really the first time in my lifetime where it feels like there are possibilities to do some really big and ambitious public programming and planning, something like a New Deal, maybe a Green New Deal, to hit the reset button, because the path that we were on before the pandemic hit was clearly an unsustainable one. And we need to do something now to turn things around.
On your Twitter bio, you say your next project is 2020, a social autopsy. I'm wondering what you can say about that work.
Well, I'm writing a book about this year. Which feels like the most consequential year of our lives. I mean, this horrible pandemic, the economic crisis related to the pandemic, and the most consequential election, are up there in American history. So, I think everything is on the line. I think everything is up in the air. And the book is primarily about the pandemic, but what the pandemic means to us over the long term is going to be determined in some way by what happens in November at the election, because the pandemic is either the prelude to a very dark time for democracy, or it's the prelude to a rebuilding of something that we need. And I think we're going to provide the answer, just not for a few more months.
I just want to ask you one last question about kind of tying together the idea of social infrastructure and the way people are responding to the pandemic. Is there something fundamentally individualistic about the American character, such that it can be generalized, that makes responding to something like a pandemic a challenge, that makes building up social infrastructure a challenge. You know, the myth of the pioneers heading west on their own, making their own way, right? The ethos of the automobile, notwithstanding columns in the New York Times calling for banning them in New York City. But in the rest of the country, it's still a dominant mode of transportation. Is there something fundamental about Americans that you see that is exacerbating the challenges we face now?
You know, I don't think it's fundamental and essential to the American character. You know, we have done great things collectively in the past. And there are a lot of other nations on earth where individualism is a prized value. But I would say that we are beyond individualism here. I mean, we are downright narcissistic. And clearly the person we elected to be our leader is pathologically narcissistic. And, you know, unfortunately, we have exactly the wrong leader for exactly the wrong moment. And the combination of just failed self-interested leadership from the White House through a ruling political party that controls the Senate and the court and has refused to put a brake on this really tyrannical ill-prepared figure has led us in the wrong direction. And so at a moment when even the kind of most basic leadership would have you say, act for the common interest, act for the public good, look out for your neighbor. That's all you needed really to get through this. And that's why every other democracy on earth has been able to turn things around. You know, we couldn't summon it. And so I don't look deep in the soul of the American character for the answer to this. I look directly at the White House and the just grotesque failure there. I think leadership really matters.
Eric Kleinenberg is the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor of Social Science at New York University, where he's also director of NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. He's also the author of Palaces for the People, Going Solo, and Heat Wave. Eric Kleinenberg, thank you so much for speaking with us on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. As ever, we'd love to hear what you thought about our conversations. Tweet us at 21stshow. That's at 21st show. You can also send us an email. That's talk at 21stshow.org. Again, the email address is talk at 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan's our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.